When I talk of money laundering, if you think of Pacific Island states, you might need to think again. The real getaway cars of the financial system are anonymous shelf companies, and they might not be based in Pacific Island states. In fact, they might be more in the West, the people who talk a lot about money laundering and cracking down on it, but might in fact house it. Joining me today to talk about just that, because he's an expert in this area, is Professor Jason Sharman, Professor of International Relations at Cambridge University. Professor Sharman, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you very much.
It's a bit of a shock for me to read some of your material suggesting that it's not the Pacific Island states and other island states as well, but really, you know, the UK, United States, even perhaps home here, plenty of shelf companies can be put together without the right ID, can't they? You've done some sort of experiment, if you like, to put this to the test.
Yeah, that's right. We were interested in kind of testing the conventional wisdom that it was palm-fringed tropical islands that are the problem when it comes to dirty money. And so we went around trying to buy anonymous shell companies and, exactly as you suggest, found out that it was much easier to buy these prohibited, untraceable companies in major financial centres like the US, the UK and Australia than in the kind of classic tax havens that feature in James Bond movies or John Grisham novels.
Well, that says, to me anyway, that the regulators talk the talk, but they're not keeping their eyes open to what's happening in their own home territory.
Yeah, I think that's true. They talk the talk, particularly when it comes to condemning small island states, but are much more gentle when it comes to vested interests in the financial sector in, as I say, Australia, Britain, the US and elsewhere.
Mm. There are good policy reasons for everybody to argue for transparency in financial transactions, just for the proper working of the financial markets. But there's another one outside of that of interest to everyone, and that is a more altruistic one, if you like, and that's getting stuck into the kleptocracy, the people in charge of developing countries who seem to be siphoning the money off to their own advantage and parking it around the world, and their people stay in poverty. They retire to great wealth. But without the help of various countries, we can't get to that, can we, easily?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, exactly as you suggest, transparency in financial affairs is generally a good thing for a number of reasons. As you say, for market function. Secondly, for just cracking down on a lot of crimes, whether it's tax evasion or fraud or laundering the proceeds of drug sales. But then also there's this idea of grand corruption or kleptocracy when leaders, generally of poor states, steal often huge amounts from their own populations and then deposit the money in rich states, in the US, Switzerland, France, Australia or wherever. And yeah, certainly this is an increasingly urgent problem and we're having a tough time addressing it.
Sure. And we interviewed someone on this program, I think probably 2 years ago now, about the risks of all the money coming in from China, because China obviously doesn't want money flowing out that ought not be, certainly doesn't want corrupt money to be parked elsewhere. But, you know, how do we know? Put it from the recipient's point of view. I'm not saying, oh, we're innocent because we don't know. You know, someone without notice, in good faith and without notice, taking the money. But if we wanted to know whether the money was clean, how would we find out?
Surprisingly, it's not actually that hard. So for some of the research that I did, I was interested in exactly this idea of do corrupt foreign politicians stash money in Australia. So I hired a private investigator. And because Australia has pretty good property records that are available online, it's actually possible just to kind of Google around the region and find the politicians who have either been charged or recommended for prosecution in their home countries. And then we built up a list of about 80-odd politicians, mostly from Papua New Guinea, and we checked them against Australian property records. These are kind of publicly available property records.
Sure.
And lo and behold, you find a lot of cross-matches, i.e. people, politicians, senior leaders, who have been charged with serious offences in their own country and yet, contrary to Australian law, have had seemingly no difficulty importing their money into Australia, usually into the real estate sector. You don't really have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out at least where a fair portion of this money is coming from and how to trace it. Mm. It's a lack of will on behalf of the Australian government, not a lack of capacity.
I mean, in principle, one should be pursuing this money, but if you don't have a heart or you don't have a brain and that doesn't get to you, at least you should be able to add up that these are poor countries, and with all that money being siphoned off, the rest of the world is forking out in foreign aid to help desperately poor people in some of these countries. And you could argue that possibly if that money had been left in those countries and put to productive, good productive use, I don't mean necessarily factories, like schools, education, health, housing, etc., and factories, the need for foreign aid would go down.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. There's this kind of ironic circularity whereby foreign aid goes from rich countries to poor countries, and yet rich countries then act as haven or hosts as funds looted from those same aid recipient countries that then is recycled back into conspicuous consumption in the West in places like Australia. So, yeah, it's a very kind of sad circular flow there.
Now, another aspect of this is you want to trace the money. You go to a country and say, here we are, we want to trace this money. We think it's here in various accounts. Is it true that some countries say, well, you show us where it is and we'll give you license to have a look at those accounts? But it makes it a bit hard if you actually don't know where it is in the first place. In other words, you show us where it's hiding and we'll let you find it. It seems a bit unfair.
Yeah, that's the way that pretty much the international legal assistance system is set up, that really you have to have 90% of the knowledge and then you can find out the other 10% in whatever the host or haven country is. And this is something that's been particularly frustrating to the Chinese government at the moment with regards to the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, elsewhere, in that the Chinese government over the last couple of years has come along to various governments and say, look, you know, we've got this list of a dozen or two dozen officials who we think are corrupt. Please, can you search through your financial system and your real estate system to find their assets and then freeze them and confiscate them and take them back to China? And this has kind of been met with incredulity or guffaws of laughter because the authorities in Australia and the US have said, you really expect us to trawl through every single bank account, every single company, and every single property record in our country, and then on the basis of not enough evidence to somehow seize these funds? This is not how it works. You have to say, look, there's this guy, Jason Sharman. He has a bank account with Westpac. The number is 123456789. The branch is whatever it might be, Street, Sydney, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, you have to have a lot of information before you can recover these funds. And exactly as you say, this does tend to create sort of catch-22 situations of, you know, you have to have the information to get the funds, but this is exactly what you're missing. You need the international assistance to get the information in the first place.
I'm talking with Professor Jason Sharman, Professor of International Relations at the University of Cambridge. We're talking about kleptocrats and where they hide their money and why we let them. I think you've been quoted as saying that weak laws with strong enforcement will do a better job than strong laws with weak enforcement. Basically, to put it simply, the cops need to be given more money to do this job.
Yeah, pretty much. I think it's two things. It's a question of kind of the guts to go after these sorts of things. And this means taking on, say, powerful vested financial interests, powerful individuals. And yeah, partly it's a question of money, although probably the political will is more important than the money there. There's this culture of kind of risk aversion. You can see that, for example, we had kind of the shocking revelations about the Commonwealth Bank accepting bags of money from drug traffickers. But, you know, if you think about Australia's had laws on the books since 1988 that have allowed very strict measures to be taken against banks. And yet so far we've had not one enforcement action against an Australian bank in the whole time since we've had the Financial Transaction Reporting Act. So that's in some ways secondarily a problem of money. That's just a problem of guts, really, of political will, of being both the Australian Federal Police and the Australian Federal Government being a little too scared to offend major banks and cause controversy there.
Okay. Well, we understand what needs to be done there. Now, what are some other things that could happen? Tougher penalties for people who help?
Yeah, I think, again, there are very tough penalties on the books and very kind of stringent powers. We've got the Australian Federal Police. We've got the Fraud and Anti-Corruption Centre, which is pretty recent. But the government sends signals about the kinds of crimes that it cares about and the kinds of crimes that it doesn't really care about. And the kind of crimes that the Australian government cares about, rightly, are the financing of terrorism, tax evasion, and outlaw motorcycle gangs. And the kinds of crimes that the Australian government cares a lot less about are things like laundering the proceeds of foreign corruption, or fraud, or various other sorts of money laundering as well. And it would be nice if the Australian Federal Police and things like AUSTRAC got more of a prompt to actually go out there and ask banks, amongst other financial intermediaries, some hard questions about how is it that we've got so much dirty money sloshing around in Australia, and we have the banks who have very strict requirements to know their customers and do customer due diligence, and yet a lot of this money seems to slip through the net. Mm. So I think some kind of hard questions need to be asked there.
Now, you also suggested using tax policy. Just briefly, can you tell me how would you do that?
Sure. So we've had a sea change internationally since the financial crisis, in that we've had a huge increase in the amount of financial information pertinent to tax affairs that gets exchanged across borders, even from previously very secretive places like the Cayman Islands and Switzerland and the United States, for that matter. But too often you have tax people doing tax policy and then anti-money laundering agencies doing anti-money laundering. And often the two don't really talk to each other that much, or the channels of information remain separate. So it'd be a lot more effective and a lot more efficient if these different parts of the bureaucracy were to put their heads together and coordinate to a much greater extent, particularly as people who are guilty of corruption crimes or money laundering crimes are also pretty commonly guilty of tax crimes as well.
Sure.
So there's all sorts of kind of synergies and efficiencies that we're not really capitalizing on at the moment.
Blacklisting kleptocracies, is that a good idea? Or the kleptocrats themselves.
Yeah, so if you've got these people who are in charge of countries, very credibly suspected of wholesale looting of their own countries, and the difficulty is, look, if you've got a sovereign head of state, then there are inherent limits to what you can do, because of course that official controls the judicial apparatus and the law enforcement apparatus in his or her own country. But you can, for example, stop such people visiting your own country. You can impose travel bans. You can publicly name and shame them. And those sorts of things are cheap, indeed pretty much free. And they're pretty effective in sending a signal and in materially inconveniencing corrupt heads of state, particularly those who have bought extremely expensive real estate in your country, who are then barred from enjoying the fruits of their corruption by, as I say, these visa denial schemes.
Yeah, sure. They're all good ideas. Now, Jason, you make me feel a bit, not guilty, depressed actually. Depressed because I was in London recently and I didn't check up whether the very innovative tourist operator that was running kleptocracy tours was still running them, because apparently you can go on, you could at least, I know you could at one point, go on these kleptocracy tours and get driven in a minibus around Mayfair, etc., and have all the houses pointed out that were to you that are purchased by kleptocrats around the world. And it's given me an idea. Perhaps we can set up a business like that in Australia. Come and have a look at, who we allow to buy what and to stay here.
I think the tour is a great idea, and more power to your arm.
Well, thanks for joining us, Professor.
Thanks very much.
That was Professor Jason Sharman from the University of Cambridge talking to us about kleptocrats nicking money and putting it here or elsewhere in the West. Shouldn't happen. You're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone.